Well, let's go ahead, and it's about 2:45. Let's go back on the record. Mr. Foss, I would remind you that you are still under oath, and Mr. O'Sullivan, you're a witness.
Mr. Foss, I want to start by talking to you about the Precor Basin contract, okay? We heard some testimony about that earlier today, correct?
Correct.
And that's the kind, but let's make sure you and I are on the same page. The contract, the all requirements wholesale power agreement that was dated January 1997.
Yes, I'm familiar with the contract.
I'm sure you are. What is the term of that contract?
It has been amended to go out to the year 2075.
So 58 years from today.
I thought we weren't going to do any of that.
I only promised you a confidential.
Okay. If you say it's 58, I'll go, okay, fair enough.
Well, subject to check, I'm going to say 58. I'm sure people who are more erudite in mathematical matters can confirm whether that's right later on. And you would agree with me that it is an all requirements contract, right?
Correct.
And by that, it means Precor must buy all of its power, all power it needs from Basin, and Basin must supply that power to Precor. Is that fair?
Correct.
Precor is not free to choose an alternative provider, right?
That's correct.
Do other Class A members of Basin have similar all requirements contracts with Basin?
Generally speaking, yes. With the exception, major exception would be Tri-State, in that the Tri-State contract is for a specific amount of power rather than all requirements, and it therefore is not an all requirements contract. The other thing, maybe it's just a detail that isn't terribly important, but in most cases, the underlying or the base power requirements that these cooperatives have is served by the Western Area Power Administration, either out of the Billings or the Lovell office. And then in some instances, for example, Corn Belt Electric in Iowa, Corn Belt has its own WAPA allocation. It's also a G&T cooperative, so it has its own generation. So we serve the increment above what Corn Belt members get from both WAPA and from Corn Belt. And then we have some instances in Minnesota. There are a handful of cooperatives that had previously gotten all of their power requirements or supplemental power requirements from Great River Energy. Great River Energy, in a contractual arrangement that was entered into on their side, gave each of their distribution cooperatives the right to go elsewhere for supplemental power requirements. And so I want to say 3 to 5 of them took that option, and they are getting their supplemental requirements above and beyond Great River, WAPA, Great River Energy, than from Basin Electric. But generally speaking, it's that delta that we serve.
Okay, and let's make sure we're on the same page. When you say that delta, I think what you're telling me is that these all requirement contracts with Basin's Class A members allow that, as a preliminary matter, these distribution co-ops will get some of their power, hydropower, WAPA allocations that are made to them. But everything else they need beyond that, Basin supplies.
Correct.
Okay. And how many Class A members are there?
There are 10 G&T members now, and there are 8 distribution cooperatives that are Class A members.
Okay, and then for the 10 that are G&T members, I assume it's accurate that the G&Ts themselves have distribution co-ops underneath each of the G&Ts.
Correct. So if you add the two together, we have 140 members.
In different classes.
Correct. In the Class A and the Class C, you have 140 total.
Okay, so Class C would be for a distribution co-op.
Correct.
That is a member of a G&T that is a Class A member of Basin?
Yes.
Thank you. Would you agree that both Basin and Precor have remaining and ongoing duties to perform under the contract for the next 58 years.
Absolutely.
The basin has to supply that power, that incremental power for 58 years.
Absolutely.
And Precor has to buy that power other than the WAPA allocation piece for the next 58 years.
Absolutely.
From basin.
Correct.
I want to go back to your testimony, and I'd actually like to reference your pre-file testimony. If you could turn to that with me, and I'm going to give you a reference here. I believe it's Precor Exhibits, not six. It is six. My apologies. Precor Exhibit 6. Will you open that? There should be a notebook here in front of you.
That's the same thing? Yeah, I've got it.
Oh, you do?
I've got my own copy of it.
Well, okay.
So I don't have to fish through the book.
Okay, fair enough. You see that is your testimony you're looking at, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I want you to turn to page 7 of your testimony with me. Let me know when you're there.
I'm there.
And I'm focusing on, I want to understand what your testimony is here with regard to the continued operation of the Synfuels plant, meaning a savings to Basin Electric of $37 million per year. And that's not a confidential number, right?
Now no, that's a historical number.
Since it's in white there, I'm assuming it's a fine number to talk about. So I believe, and correct me if I misconstrue, but I believe what your testimony references here and in your live testimony today, I think you testified the same fact that it made sense for Basin to bid on the Great Plains Synfuel plant when the DOE essentially put it up to auction to preserve the benefits that you're talking about here, right?
Correct.
And the benefits we're talking about, and to be clear, these are benefits that existed and even predated Basin's ownership of the Great Plains Synfuel plant, right?
Well, what I understand the $37 million to represent is what it would have cost Basin Electric a year had that facility not been there. So, yes, I think that's analytically correct.
Okay, in other words, if
we were enjoying a benefit of $37 million a year up to that point, and we were going to lose that benefit going forward.
If DGC ceased to exist.
Correct.
Okay.
The plant ceased to operate, yes.
Okay, and the three specific benefits you're talking about were power sales. That's one of them, right?
Yeah, 90 megawatt load, correct.
One of the words, let's be clear, Basin served the DGC load.
Correct.
Right. And Basin serves the DGC load today, right?
Correct.
And if there was another bidder in the DOE auction, right?
Yes, the Coastal Corporation.
So assume with me hypothetically that Coastal Corporation had been the winning bidder and it acquired Great Plains Synfuel. Are you with me?
Yes.
Okay. In that event, Basin still would have continued to serve the DGC load, right?
For as long as the Coastal Corporation operated the plant, correct?
Right, as long as the plant existed and had a load to be served, right?
Correct.
So the fact that there's a benefit we ascribe to power sales doesn't tie to the fact that Basin owns DGC. It ties to the fact that DGC has an electrical need and Basin serves it, right?
So long as the plant operates, yes.
Right, because we know because that benefit existed even before Basin acquired the Great Plains Synfuel plant.
How the benefit was measured, yes.
And the second benefit, the economies of scale of the large coal mining operations. The notion there is that Basin and the Antelope Valley plant that you talked about, Antelope Valley Station and DGC basically share a backyard or an industrial complex, I believe you said, right?
Right.
And because they share some that complex and some operational expenses, there's synergies, there's economies of scale that make it less expensive than it otherwise would be if Basin had to do this on a standalone basis, right?
Correct.
So the fact that DGC is there to share in those costs is something you identify as a benefit to Basin that Basin wanted to preserve.
Yes. Could I back up just a second? I'm sitting here. I'm thinking about your first. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'm mistaken.
And then lastly, I want to talk about and you talked about some shared or common facilities between Basin and DGC, right?
Correct.
And those still exist today, right?
They do.
And excuse me while I leave back here, but I think you referenced things like a rail line, a water treatment pond, et cetera.
Right, water treatment facilities.
Okay, and the notion there,
raw water pipeline taking water from underneath the lake and bringing it to the plant site.
So the notion there, and correct me if I misunderstand it, is that both Basin and DGC need those facilities.
Correct.
And as is often the case, two can live more cheaply than one, right?
Correct.
They share the cost of those shared facilities.
Right.
But and it's also correct that Basin shared those costs with the Great Plains Synfuel plant even before Basin acquired the Great Plains Synfuel plant, right?
Correct.
So those benefits, those embedded benefits that we've just talked about there, aren't, at least those benefits, aren't attributable to the fact that Basin owns DGC. They're attributable, in essence, to the fact that DGC remains open and operational.
The plant itself remains open and operational, correct.
There has been, and you've heard some of this, some discussion. Well, we just had some discussion. We didn't talk numbers, but there's been discussion about the benefits that Basin claims that DGC flows through to Basin, right?
Correct.
There's basically, I'm going to say there's two essential categories of those benefits. One is what I will call, for lack of a better word, hard benefits that show up as dividends, actual dividends that DGC makes to Basin.
Correct. Yes, I would agree with that.
And we looked at an exhibit. Commissioner Brighton actually worked through an exhibit. I think it was the Precourse Exhibit 2.2 that reflected that when Basin makes dividends, I'm sorry, when DGC makes dividends to Basin, those can find expression either in the form of a bill credit to an entity like Precor or an augmentation of their patronage capital. Is that right?
That's right.
But there's also been a lot of discussion about what I'll call, and as I categorize these in my mind, the softer benefits, or what some folks have called the embedded benefits. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
I do.
And the items we just talked about, the fact that Basin sells power to DGC, the fact that they have some synergies with regard to coal operations, the fact that they share facilities, those are what we call embedded benefits, right?
Correct.
And those are the benefits. I believe we heard Mr. Easley testify to this, but he said those have been estimated in the range of $90 million per year?
Currently, yes.
Okay. Currently.
As I mentioned earlier, it initially was $37 million. And over the course of time, actually, if you take $37 million and escalate it, ironically, you come up with the same number.
Okay. These benefits have been quantified by somebody, right?
Right, not me.
do you know who did that quantification?
Well, Ms. Sorensen would be one of the people that worked on that.
It was Basin then, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Basin has not commissioned an independent study and quantification of those DGC benefits, right?
No. Again, you would be bringing somebody in, educating them, telling them the economics, the operation, and they would turn around and tell you what you just told them and bill you for it.
But they, fair enough, but they would be an independent evaluation.
I don't know how independent that is, I guess, is what I would say, but yes, theoretically, it would be an independent evaluation.
Well, let me ask you this. You can understand that from the joint intervener's perspective, there's going to be some skepticism, for lack of a better word, as to the magnitude of the quantification of those benefits. I'm not asking you to agree with me on the proposition. I'm asking you that from our perspective, you might understand that we want to know if there's really $90 million of embedded benefits.
Well, and I can assure you that Mr. Easley and his likewise have a fairly keen interest in that and want to make sure that the numbers that we're writing them are accurate and correct.
But you were hearing Mr. Easley testify, weren't you?
I was.
And you heard him say something to this effect that that Precor didn't do any independent effort to verify that quantification of embedded benefits. Did you hear that?
I heard that. On the other hand, I've been present at the presentations. I have witnessed the questions that Mr. Easley and the other Class A members have asked. And I would say that they assured themselves in those manager's advisory committees that the numbers are accurate. Well, and the other thing is, as I testified, this goes back to 1988. This is not a new concept. These are, the numbers change, but the way you calculate the numbers haven't changed since 1988.
The way you calculate the numbers, right?
Correct.
But the numbers have changed.
Right.
And I think you said primarily you alluded to, for lack of a better term, inflation over time.
And all I said is it's kind of coincidental. Somebody went, I wonder what $37 million is if you took it and, took the time value of money and took it out to 2017. And they go, oh, my God, guess what? It's, about $90 million. And we went, well, yeah, I guess that probably makes sense.
So somebody actually did that exercise.
Right.
Who did that exercise?
Maybe Ms. Hartson. I was just in a room when the topic came up and I heard someone say that.
So the notion was if you took $37 million in 1988 and grew it at a specified discount rate, it would result in a $90 million figure by 2017?
Correct.
And do you have any idea what that discount rate was?
No, I don't know.
But that was the notion, is that money grows over time, yeah, hopefully. Would basins be open? I'm sorry.
Could you just pause between the questions and answers a little bit?
That was my first admonishment, and I will. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Would basin be open to undertaking an independent evaluation and quantification of the embedded benefits that it claims?
Once again, we have a question that's beyond my pay grade. I'm just not in a position to answer that myself.
Well, you're the general counsel, right?
That's right. I'm just the general counsel, as how my boss would put it.
Is that what? Is that just a lowly lawyer?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that a question you could take to the Basin Board?
Good.
Is that a question you're willing to take to the Basin Board?
I have no problem doing so, no.
Would you recommend it to the Basin Board that I was in this hearing and...
Well, they'd probably ask who's paying for it.
They might. But before we get to the issue of who's paying for it, let's assume that there's going to be some ongoing disagreement between the parties, Precorp and the joint interveners, as to what the amount or notion is of those embedded benefits. Let's just assume that with me, okay?
Sure.
Wouldn't it be reasonable then to have someone who doesn't have an interest in the issue evaluate what the nature and the quantification of those embedded benefits are?
Based on the assumption, yes.
I don't have anything further. Thank you, Mr. Foss.
Thank you, Mr. Roselli. Ms. Fish, do you have any questions of Mr. Foss?
I do, just a couple. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Foss.
Good afternoon.
Can you tell me what other for-profit subsidiaries that Basin has?
Good question. Thank you. Actually, we have several. And I'll just touch on the major ones. I refer to them as boxes, if you will. And it makes for an interesting tax return because you have the Basin Electric business that's done on a cooperative basis, and then you have a separate way then of the traditional corporate way then of calculating taxes for these other subsidiaries. So we have Dakota Gasification Company, operates the Great Plains Synfuels plant, is in the business of selling natural gas, fertilizers, carbon dioxide for tertiary oil recovery and a number of other types of products. Then we have a Dakota Coal Company, which I mentioned in my direct testimony, which purchased the mining assets. It's also in the limestone and the lime business, which is a product then that we use for scrubbers for environmental compliance. And then we have two wind subsidiaries, two companies that own large wind farms. One is called Prairie Wind South Dakota, and it is obviously located in South Dakota. And Prairie Winds North Dakota, which obviously is located in North Dakota. Those were incorporated separately and are taxable entities so as to realize there was a period of time under the tax code where in lieu of taking credits for your wind generation, you could actually get a check up front from the Treasury. So we opted to take the check up front. And so each of these entities then run independently of one another. And it's the income and loss from all of them that, you then use for your consolidated income or loss. And it's your consolidated income or loss then that the street, the markets, the insurance companies, the banks, the loans, or lending companies look to in terms of whether they will lend to you and at what rate.
So in regard to the surpluses and losses, is Precorp similarly affected by these, like DGC in regard to those?
Yes, as a matter of fact, again, very good question. Because of the tax-driven nature of the investment in the Prairie Wind subsidiaries, for book purposes, they actually operate at approximately $5 million loss each year, both of them. So collectively, it's a $10 million loss. The rates we set at Basin Electric, as I said earlier, are designed to drive a consolidated income, which again is how you're measured for the rating agencies and the investing community.
And then my last question is, have any other utility companies that Basin provides power to shown an alarm in this rate increase due to subsidiary losses?
Well, I tell you what, the better question would be, did anybody not raise holy hell? Nobody likes rate increases, and rate increases are bad. Mid-year rate increases are terrible. People throw rocks at you. So yes, they were all going, oh my God, you got to be kidding. And we had a Managers Advisory Committee walk them through just exactly what was driving all of this. Frankly, I think in the course of that meeting, I think we more or less confessed that looking back with 2020 hindsight, that we had been undercharging the members for too long and basically stealing from Peter to pay Paul, taking money out of Dakota Gasification Company that we should have now just left there, and using Dakota Gasification Company earnings to subsidize the rates to the members.
Thank you. That is all my questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fish. Mr. Walker,
you? No questions.
Ms. Cusick?
No questions.
Commissioner Brighton?
I don't have any questions, but thank you for your testimony. The history is fascinating.
Deputy Chair Russell, questions?
I do have one. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Foss.
Mr. Russell?
First of all, let me say ditto to Commissioner Brighton. It was a good history lesson, and it adds context to what we're doing here. In the process, you said one thing almost in passing that struck me as possibly a key element to how we approach this case, which, by the way, is relatively rare coming from a witness who is also an attorney.
Okay. I saw that coming.
You mentioned that a lot of people in this room were getting the cost issue associated with Dakota wrong. And it kind of went by fast, and I wonder if you could go back to that and tell us what you meant.
Okay, thank you. And I'm gonna go back to the boxes that I was talking about. You have the Basin box, you have the Dakota Gasification Company box, you have the Dakota Coal box, and then you have the two wind boxes. The last box is a consolidated box. As Susan will testify, the last box is what the street looks at. What's your consolidated? That's what they look at during the rating agencies. And so this rate increase was designed for consolidated income. So it's for the last box. But to get there, you have a DGC loss. We typically are able to price coal such that we rarely ever have a loss at Dakota Coal. So that's by and large neutral. And then we have the two $5 million losses. And you put that all together to come up with the number you need down here, but you charge that at the basin side. There's no leakage from Dakota gasification companies. I said nobody's coming and asking basin to pay the bills. But your margin then, based on that rate, is all at the basin electric level. So, for example, as a result of the initial rate coupled with the rate increase, we don't have audited financials. And again, Susan's the number person. But we have a net margin at the basin level, box one, of approximately $150 million this year. If Precor represents approximately 10%, you're talking something just under $15 million margin that'll be allocated to Precor's account for this year. So there's no, the basin isn't paying money to DGC and then trying to collect that from Precor.
I'll process that for a while. I think I got it. Thank you. That's all I have.
Which also answers the question of why anyone that's a member instinctively understands that they're not breaking out DGCC, that the way their rates are set is the way you just described, and they don't think about it in terms of carving out DGC or DCC.
You know, I would go back to 1988. As I said, the vote was unanimous. We all held hands and went, we're going forward with this together. There's going to be some ups and downs for the, and historically, when Basin has been in trouble, just the coincidence, DGC was doing well and DGC could help Basin. In the past, if DGC was doing poorly, there was Basin there to help. This is the first time where we had a perfect storm where, the electric business was impacted. The DGC business was impacted. We've talked a lot about energy today. Obviously, Basin serves coal load, gas load, oil load. They were all hurting. Other than residential, the balance is ag. We serve just a tremendous amount of ag. We've had just bountiful crops, but no prices. And so we've described it internally as a perfect storm. Everything went to hell at the same time. Never happened before. That's not to say it couldn't happen again, but it's the first time it's happened in almost 30 years we've had DGC.
Can I follow up on that just real quickly?
Please do.
Thank you. In looking at Exhibit 2.2, though, those specific dividend amounts that were provided in 2007, 2008, 2009, and 2011, those were specifically identified as DGC. Dividends.
Right, that's where dividends would come from.
Thanks.
All right. Cross-examination, Ms. Good.
I do have some follow-up questions.
Please proceed.
Mr. Foss, can I take you to 2.2 and to page 7 where those dividend amounts are listed?
Page 7.
We keep coming back to the fact that these are DGC dividends, but those, we're talking about DGC dividends to Basin, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then we talked about contracts being extended through 2075. Can you tell us why?
Well, first of all, there's an engineering reality backstopping it. We just come to the conclusion that our assets have the ability to have much longer lives than the FERC system of accounts provided. And when I say assets, I'm talking of coal generation, gas generation, and then transmission. And so we discussed in the membership extending the contracts, and basically in exchange for extending the contracts from the year 2050 to 2075. For those members that did so, we would basically compute their bill and using these extended depreciation lives versus the previous lives that had been assigned to them under FERC.
And what did that do to those members' bills?
It would reduce the member bills. We refer to it as a contract extension credit.
There was some discussion about the embedded benefits and the fact that those existed before Basin took over the plant. And you kept saying, yeah, they would have continued so long as the plant continued operating. Did Basin have some understanding about what Coastal Corporation, the other bidder, would have done with that plant?
Well, as I said both in my prepared testimony and a little earlier, we were fairly certain unless gas prices came up quite a bit higher. And again, at this point, the gas is being driven down to a market price. We assumed that they would operate the plant so that all of the tax benefits would vest. They would continue to enjoy the production tax credit associated with producing the gas. And then at that point, if it wasn't profitable, they'd walk.
There was also, or there were, questions about third-party analysis. Are Basin or DGC audited by a third party?
Well, differently. Dakota Gasification Company, we initially, in our negotiations with the Department of Energy, obviously were price sharing, profit sharing, and so they wanted to make sure that we weren't gaming the system, and so we agreed back in 1988, excuse me, with the Department of Energy that we would have audited annual financials that we would provide to them. After we got through the profit sharing period and no longer had an obligation to the Department of Energy, the thought process was, you know, it's probably just good business in terms of our relationship with the members to have an audited standalone audited financials for DGC. And then there are no, what I've referred to as box one, Basin Electric, there's no standalone box one audited financials for Basin, but there is then for the entire consolidated group.
You also got asked questions about the increasing number of the embedded benefits. Do you know what Basin's average mill rate was back in 1988 when this was taken over?
It's in my prepared testimony, or file testimony.
And what I'm getting at, Mr. Foss, is what's the difference between that and what it is today?
Well, you're talking numbers, but frankly, it's the numbers aren't that much different considering that this was 1988.
There has also been a question about DGC being classified as non-electric by Basin, and you talked about how it's electricity related. How are the Prairie Winds facilities classified by Basin?
Well, they're also typically the non-electric really means non-utility, and I would note that both the Prairie Winds subsidiaries are considered non-utility or non-electric property.
From Basin's standpoint, what happens if the commission disallows the requested pass-on?
Well, there'll be a tough decision for the or maybe not that tough decision for the Basin Electric Board of Directors. The fundamental principle of a cooperative, particularly a cooperative power supplier, is you have one rate for everyone. So it would be an anathema to think that we would provide, you know, a different rate for Powder River than the other members. It's also hard to believe that if we did agree to that, that the other members would sit on their hands and go, oh, that's okay. So I would expect, you know, I can't speak for my client and what they would do, but one would assume more likely than not that you would be faced with, assuming Precor did not pay, you would be faced with a lawsuit, Precor would be faced with a lawsuit by Basin Electric and the other Class A members.
Can you tell us very briefly what the strategy or the vision for DGC is going forward?
Well, unlike, I think, a number of utilities in the United States, Basin Electric is committed to coal. We think it's the nation's greatest resource. We believe we have two of the main pieces of the future of coal generation in the United States, in the world, really. We have the coal gasification, which turns coal into a gas. And then, as I mentioned earlier in my testimony, we actually take a fairly large percentage of the carbon dioxide that's produced by the plant. We put that under high pressure and we send that up to Canada for tertiary oil recovery. We are dealing with a few companies that are doing a demonstration project in Texas right now for a process called the Allen process. The Allen process is an electrical generation process that, in lieu of using the fuel or using steam for a generator, actually what it drives is carbon dioxide itself. And it's a system that produces a relatively pure carbon dioxide. And so what we are attempting to, and we're asking the state of North Dakota to provide some funding. We're also speaking with the Department of Energy to see if they would fund the bulk of this to move an alum cycle generation facility up at the Synfuels plant to see if we can demonstrate this technology. If we could, we believe that that would represent the future of electric generation using coal in the world, because you would have a process that would not emit any carbon dioxide. You know, and part of our dedication, if you will, because it's atypical, I think, in most of the utilities in the United States, and a lot of them, this recent downturn with gas prices, a lot of them went, you know, why am I banging my head against the wall trying to make coal work when I can just close it, have a commission go, yeah, build a gas plant, pass the cost through, no problem. Here, you know, you don't have the separation of interest between the owners and the consumers. They're one and the same. We're sitting on top of probably the, you know, the biggest coal reserves in the world. For God's sake, why wouldn't we see if we could use those?
I have no further questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Foss, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Ms. Good, if you would call your next witness, please.
Precor calls Susan Sorensen.
Sorensen, if you would raise your right hand, please. You swear that the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, subject to penalty of perjury?
I do.
Thank you. Ms. Good, you are a witness.
Thank you. Ms. Sorensen, will you please state your name for the record?
Susan Jo Sorensen.
And where are you employed?
I work for Basin Electric.
What is your position there?
I am the vice president and treasurer.
And how long have you worked for Basin?
I've worked for Basin for 8 years. I've been in this position for just over 2 years.
Did you file testimony in this matter?
I filed rebuttal testimony, yes.
Have you had a chance to review that pre-filed rebuttal testimony before appearing today?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to that testimony?
I don't.
Do you believe that your testimony on direct exam here today under oath would be similar to that of your pre-filed testimony?
Yes.
Will you please summarize that testimony for the commission?
Sure. So in my testimony, I attempted to explain why Basin needed the 2016 mid-year rate increase. I talk about the steps that we took in an effort to avoid having to do the mid-year rate increase. I talk about the forces that were outside of our control that offset those efforts to delay or avoid the increase. I also discuss our relationship with our subsidiary companies and how that the subsidiary companies are completely intertwined with our utility operations, and how the benefit of the DGC, especially those benefits, come back and are embedded into the operations of DGC. I try to clarify the impacts that weather and commodity prices had on the deterioration of what our member rate was bringing in for our financial statements, and the importance of those financial statements and the outcome of those at the end of the year for our bond rating
reviews that we have with three of our rating agencies. I also highlight that it's a strategic initiative of our board of directors to maintain an A rating and how we need to operate our business in order to achieve that strategic initiative. And then I try to tie all of these pieces together. These pieces are very complex and there are multiple moving parts of which you can't specifically pull one piece of that out and say that this was quantified in this way. And the reason for that is because an impact that might have happened here, kind of like squeezing a balloon, you push something here and something pops out over here, and it's all related because everything is kind of bundled up into one ball. I talk about how those multiple moving parts are integrated into our rate setting process. I also talk about the time, and I think this is a very important part of the testimony in that what did we know at the time that we were making certain decisions, and that as we were moving through our financial forecast process for 2016 through 26, which is our 10-year financial forecast. I talk about the timing of when that was approved, what happens when that approval goes into effect, and when those rates change. And then I also talk a little bit about the flaws that I identified in Mr. Higgins' testimony regarding the calculation of the percentage of the rate increase that was attributable to the DGC losses. And so, again, coming back to how very complex and integrated and interdependent all of these moving parts are, none of which can be individually singled out.
You mentioned that you talk about the factors that resulted in the mid-year rate increase. Was DGC the primary factor that resulted in that rate increase?
I wouldn't say so, no. No.
Were Consolidated's financial metrics involved?
Yes.
How so?
Again, as Mark, Mr. Foss had related in his testimony here, when we go to rating agencies, when we go out to the public markets or the private markets, insurance companies and banks to raise money, capital, get funding for our capital projects, they're looking at the consolidated financial statements. And so it's my job, or part of my job, to manage those consolidated financial statements. And so that's the piece that I focus on as far as the consolidated impact.
What were the metrics that you were looking at in determining whether a rate increase was necessary?
So the rating agencies use a pretty similar platform for the way that they rate cooperatives in the utility business. And there are five financial metrics that are part of that model that they use, and we've identified those. We specifically in-house at Basin use the Moody's methodology. It's very similar. You get a similar outcome to compared to S&P or Fitch. But there are five financial metrics, and those five financial metrics each have a weighting to them, but together they make up 40% of our overall bond rating. And so the five metrics include our TIER, which is the times interest earned ratio. The second one is a debt service coverage ratio. Then there is a funds from operations, or your cash from operations over interest. And then a funds from operation or cash from operations over debt. And then the last one is an equity to capitalization calculation. And so again, all of those five components or metrics add up to be 40% of our total rating.
Was Basin Consolidated in danger of failing any of those?
Yes, we were. Again, our goal is to maintain solidly in the A category, and each of those categories has a range. So X percent or X times, you're an A plus, and then you move on down the tiers. At the time that we're entering into our financial forecast in 2015. So backing the clock all the way up to the February timeframe of 2015, when we were starting our process for the 2016 through 2026 10-year financial forecast, We were rated at an A1 by Moody's, an A+ by Fitch, and an A by S&P. All of those ratings had a stable outlook behind them, meaning that they affirmed our rating. They felt that we were solidly, they didn't have any concern about looking at us for an upgrade, nor did they have a concern about looking at us for a downgrade at that time. When we moved into past 2015, we were seeing impacts on our load. We were seeing impacts on our consolidated metrics that made those all of those metrics were starting to fall out of that A category and into a high B or even a medium B. And so at that time, Moody's put us on a negative outlook, meaning that they were going to review us for a downgrade. We also, in 2015, if you were to look at our audited consolidated financial statements, we had a net margin of only $8 million. And that $8 million was not enough to boost our metrics up to where we needed them to be in that A category. So as we were going through the budgeting process and looking at those metrics and how what we needed to do to boost them back up to reverse any further degradation or downward movement in our bond ratings, we came out with we needed to have a consolidated net income in that $50 million range in order to start to reverse some of the downward trend that we were seeing in the financial metrics.
So when you decided you needed the mid-year increase and you were looking at the $50 million, without the $50 million, which of those five categories was base and consolidated failing in?
All of them. They were all below the A category.
With the $50 million increase, where would Basin have been?
We started to, on not all of them, but on, I would say, if I had to guess, three out of the five, the $50 million started to move us back into that A category. Now, one of the things with, once you get downgraded by a rating agency, I equate it to weight gain. It's really easy to gain the weight. It takes forever to lose the weight, and you have to go through a lot of hard work and a lot of willpower and discipline. And so now, even though that we have started to show an upward trajectory or upward trend on those financial metrics, it's going to take some time, and we have some proof that we have stabilized our financial condition in order for them to reverse the downgrade and move us back into that A category, which is ultimately our goal. And that's important to us because, and I think Mr. Easley's testimony this morning talked about those bond ratings are important to us because that's where we determine our cost of debt. So it's not unlike our personal credit ratings. When you go out to take a mortgage or a car loan, whatever, they go out and look at your credit score. And that determines what rate you pay for that money. Well, when we're talking about right now, we have a consolidated debt on our balance sheet of about $4.8 billion. We're just heading into the market this spring for in the range of about a $500 million debt offering. And so when you start to multiply that big of a borrowing times a few basis points, meaning a few percentage points, every drop in a category from an A to an A minus to a triple B plus, it adds dollars or it adds percentage points to the debt rate that you pay. And so that equates to a significant amount of interest expense that Basin then has to recover in the member rates.
In your PowerPoint slides, there's a term that the joint interveners have cued in on in terms of talking about these factors that led to the mid-year rate increase, the term equity infusion regarding DGC. Did that ever happen?
The equity infusion never happened. And I would also like to point out that the equity infusion coincidentally, that was an issue that was raising at the same time that we were seeing this degradation in our financials. However, the two are two completely separate issues. One did not impact the other.
I'll pass the witness for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Good. Cross-examination, Mr. Hickey?
Yes, Mr. Roselli.
Mr. Roselli, your witness. Thank you, Mr. Roselli. Good afternoon, Ms. Sorensen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Roselli.
You know who I am, so I'm not going to reintroduce myself. You were in the room when I was talking with Mr. Foss, right?
Right.
I am going to give you the same initial request that I gave Mr. Foss, and I think it will be more pertinent for the discussion you and I are about to have. In your pre-filed testimony, there are some numbers and certainly some of the slides and the financial analysis you did for Basin. They certainly contained confidential information. Is that right?
Correct.
So as we're talking, I'm going to do my utmost best to make sure that I observe those requirements. And before you volunteer a number in response to any of my questions, just take a moment to make sure that you're confident it's a public figure, okay?
Okay.
I will tell you I've done the best I can to segregate my cross-examination and partition everything that I think is confidential towards the very end of the examination, but we'll keep each other honest on this, okay? I'd like to start by having you go to exhibit 234.4 with me, please. I think your counsel is going to help you find it.
I shanked the numbers question right off the bat.
All right, do you have the right book now?
Thanks to the help and the lawyers in the room. Yep, I am now there.
Okay. And I want you to turn in that exhibit actually to the third page. It's got a two tiny number in the bottom. It says JI0059. Do you see that?
Yes.
By the way, I assume you've testified before in some manner of trial or hearing or administrative proceeding. Is that correct?
No, that is not correct.
This is your first time?
Yes.
Well, welcome to the club. I will tell you that those little teeny-tiny numbers are what we call Bates numbers, and they help us make sure that we're on the same page as we're talking to documents or talking to witnesses about documents. So I'll reference those numbers from time to time. Or I might just reference the page number of the actual document when it was next expedient. This document, and again, I'm referencing the little Bates number of JI0059, but right from the cover page, it should look familiar to you, does it?
I recognize my name in the financial forecast, yes.
Yeah, the document says financial forecast Sue Sorensen, right?
Correct.
Got you.
Yes, right. It is.
So you prepared this financial forecast document, Ms. Sorensen?
I believe so, but, you know, I do so many presentations that I'm not specifically placing this one as I don't see a specific date on it.
Do you know when this document was prepared?
I can assume.
Well, tell me what you believe.
I believe that this must have been prepared based on the slides underneath, that it was probably sometime in August or September of 2016.
Why would you believe that?
Because our financial forecast gets approved by our board in August of 2000 of any given year. We usually don't present any numbers until that is approved by our board.
Okay, so I'm following. Because this is a financial forecast document, that's why you think it would date to the August or September timeframe in 2016.
Yes.
Did you present this document to the Basin Board?
I would not have presented this to the Basin Board, no.
Would anybody have presented this document to the Basin Board?
Yes. One of my staff, who is the manager of our budgeting and forecasting group, is typically the one that presents this to our board.
You would have been present at that board meeting? Do you remember being present at that board meeting?
Explicitly, probably. I cannot say yes, but I am present at most board meetings for most presentations, especially when it's my staff presenting.
Probably, especially when the presentation has your name on it, right?
Well, yeah, that's the kicker, is I'm assuming that this was a presentation maybe not made to our board, but instead made to a member advisory committee or... probably to the member advisory committee or some other smaller group other than our board.
So you're not sure sitting here whether this was presented to the board?
Not this specific presentation.
Okay. I'd like you to turn with me, and it might be easier just to give you references to the page number of the document as opposed to the teeny Bates numbers. So I want you to go with me to what's marked page 19 of 44 within this document.
All right, yes, in there.
If you've done this successfully, you should be looking at a document or a page that says net income slash loss after tax. Is that where you are?
Yes, it is.
Is this slide familiar to you?
Yes.
Let me start with this. Can you tell us what the blue line on this slide represents?
The blue line represents the 2026 to 2025 financial forecast that we had completed and was approved by the board in August of 2015.
August of 2015.
Correct.
Okay, so I'm going to focus on the blue line to start, and I want to make sure I'm reading this correctly, okay?
Okay.
I believe it's telling me, by the way, this is a financial, let's clear this up first. This is a financial forecast just for the DGC entity, right?
Yes.
And we know that from the upper right-hand corner where it says financial forecast DGC.
Right.
Right. So this is not a consolidated view. This is a focus on DGC.
Correct.
Okay. So I'm understanding what you told me about what the blue line represents and the blue figures associated with the blue line. It looks like based on the 2016 to 2025 financial forecast, in the year 2017, Basin originally projected a $24 million loss for DGC. This is net income or net loss after tax in 2017. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And then following the trend of the blue line, it projected $17 million in positive net income after tax for DGC in the year 2018. Right?
Yes, right.
And then I won't take you through the whole line, but in the year 2019, showing a positive $29 million net income after tax or DGC. That's what's being projected in that original financial forecast, right?
Right.
Okay. Now I want to focus on the red and blue bars and the bar graph portion of this slide, okay?
The red and green?
I'm sorry. I guess that is green. Semi-colorblind, yes. So tell us what those bars represent, please.
Those bars represent the financial forecast for 2017 through 26, as prepared and approved by our board of directors in August of 2016, so 1 year later.
So it's the same exercise. It's basically a 10-year financial forecast. The bars represent the financial forecast that was done in August of 2016 for DGC, and the blue curved line represents the financial, the 10-year financial forecast that was done for DGC in August of 2015. Is that right?
That is right.
Okay. So looking at this, focusing on the bars, a year has lapsed since the 2015 financial forecast was done, the blue line forecast, right? And now Basin is projecting in year 2017 a $67 million loss for a DGC after tax?
Yes.
And then following in 2018, Basin projecting a $60 million loss in 2018?
That's right.
And a $27 million loss in 2019? Mm-hmm. And then an $18 million loss in 2020, right? So as that forecast was updated, Basin was now showing four consecutive years of net losses after tax for DGC, right?
Unfortunately, yes.
And I don't want you to tell me a number because I'm not sure if that number is confidential. I'm not sure why it would necessarily be in light of what we're talking about here, but DGC also had a net loss after tax in 2016, didn't it?
Yes, year end.
Yes.
Yes, our estimated, we haven't closed our books and the audit is not complete, but indications are the estimate is that there will be a net loss.
Was there a net loss for DGC in, this is after tax, in the year 2015?
Unless I looked at an audit statement, I couldn't tell you whether or not.
Okay.
I don't recall.
All right. Without looking at a document or reviewing it.
Mr. Rosalie, why don't we go ahead and take a break until 4 o'clock and we'll reconvene.
Very good, Mr. Berber.
Thank you.